I've spoken to some length on the period between 1929 and the outbreak of war, 1939. I would now like to speak on the immediate aftermath of the war, my visit back to Germany, specifically to see the friends that yet lived in Cologne. While two-thirds of Cologne was destroyed by numerous raids and finally, of course, the military onslaught, it was, I think, the 1,000 bomber raids on numerous occasions, high explosives and incendiary bombs, which destroyed the city, or most of it. A city of some 80,000 people in 1939. 80,000 people were killed in one raid. When I look back upon this, my first impression of Germany that I saw in 1946, immediately after the war, I had difficulty in getting a visa to go there. I had to apply to the military authorities. However, when I did get there, they had just completed a temporary bridge across the River Rhine, and the whole place was in a shambles. A little temporary lighting had been fixed up at the main Bahnhof, but there was no street lighting, and only a few odd houses here and there were able to be connected to a very dim power, sort of power. The lights were very dim, there was hardly any real power there. Villainy of all description was rampant. They were rather lucky in Cologne, inasmuch as it was the so-called Allies. When I say so-called, I do not include the Americans, because the Americans could be described as the worst, I would say, of their enemies, on account of the calculated and diabolical tricks. I can't think of a better word. Tricks. The hierarchy of the occupied forces, whoever they were at the time, must have closed not one eye, but both eyes to the iniquity which prevailed. And there before me, when I saw Cologne in daylight the next day, I gazed upon what I considered to be the world's greatest tragedy. Germany was literally made to crawl. The American forces there had black troops in occupation in very large numbers. My friend's house was one of the few which had survived the several near misses, whilst was in fact a small island which yet remained on a whole vista of devastation. And she lived right at the top in a little tiny, I suppose you would call it a penthouse, or a little tiny flat right at the top of this building on the corner. Her and her husband Her husband, incidentally, was an invalid from the First World War. And what she was able to tell me, and with evidence and proof of what she had to say, was really a very sickening experience, the whole business. The privations of the war itself, the endless bombings, were far easier to sustain than the shock of what had to take place that the victorious Allies entered the city. The American soldiers wandered through the city in bands of three or four, and sometimes more. Anyone that was caught on the street were immediately stopped and searched, and any valuables were taken from them. Wristwatches, pens, any items of jewellery like rings and things like that were taken from them. They had no option whatsoever, they just had to hand them over. No woman was safe on the street, from young girls up to women of 60 were taken at will. I do not exaggerate, this is perfectly true. While the husband was out one evening, shortly before I arrived there, trying to get the odd few marks, as it were, to try and buy something to eat and to hold body and soul together, the door was battered down by a small contingent of American soldiers, most of whom were colored. Because she would not freely consort with them, they proceeded to smash the place up. Now, it must be recalled that I knew these people, I knew the flat, I knew the furniture. I'd stayed there on so many occasions. I knew the furniture as if it were a room of my own. And there I saw the handiwork of these people. Nice cabinets were smashed with bayonets and rifle butts. The settee was slashed from one end to the other. The armchair, the arms of which were both ripped open. My friends had made an attempt to stitch them up temporarily because they could not afford to buy any other stuff. And had it have been available, it must be recalled in 1946, nothing was available. They were way back worse than at any period during the unemployed period before Hitler's time. Mounds and mounds of rubble. The boss, what men remained, were doing their best to restore the essential services, such as sewage, electric light, telephone, railways. The people who were left to try and clear the rubble from the streets and use some of the building material were elderly people, old age pensioners, and children. I've seen them sitting day after day, chipping the old mortar from bricks so that they could be used again. Grandmothers who should have been retired and just pottering around in the kitchen had to sit amongst all this muck and debris. Mountains and mountains of debris under which still human corpses were still underneath. And they all had same expression. The shockwave was still on them of the war, its aftermath, and what they were living through. A black market existed. Anything that was worth anything, if one, a girl, would probably sleep with a soldier, or anyone for that matter, if her parents were hungry, for a bar of chocolate, for a loaf of bread, for a packet of cigarettes, for a piece of cheese, for a few potatoes. Only those who were there at the time can recall the gross sadness, the hollow cheeks of the undernourished people who had suffered to such a degree, who went about their daily chores just like so many zombies, with no future, with no direction, just what was immediately before them. Bridges across the Rhine were all down. Most of these bridges were destroyed by the Germans themselves in an attempt to hold the Allied advance. But the barges and ships, which were half submerged along the whole length of the Rhine, were the handiwork for the most part of the Allied bombers. Such devastation, it is very, very difficult to explain. Old Cologne, which existed down to the waterfront, where such beautiful little old-fashioned beer houses existed, among which was one very notable place known as Brung's Wine House, or Beer Cellar, Beer Keller, rather. All of the whole area was completely obliterated. Completely obliterated, and the area, for the most part, was never rebuilt. I think a large part of what used to be that old Cologne is now a huge bus terminal which goes all over the place. Now, of course, I have been back to Germany on many occasions since 1946, and I have noticed that again, once again, through dint of their hard work, their technology and all the rest of the trimmings that go with the German way of life, they've been able to restore a very high degree of economy, but at a price, I repeat, at a terrible price. The price they have had to pay to get back into the rat race which exists today in the world has been submission to the International Grabber Society and the International Pornographers, the International Bankers, and more strangely still, the people who they were accused of destroying have suddenly reappeared. Huge numbers of these people, who it has been alleged were destroyed by the Germans, have just somehow seemed to come out of the woodwork. They have returned to reclaim houses and land after having been, had come back from the dead, as it were, these people. I have no doubt a large number of these people come to an untimely end, but when they speak in terms of 6 million, this, of course, anyone who really understands this business, were it not for the tragic and serious side of the whole business, must split their sides in laughter, because this is, there is no way that they could sustain such nonsense. But we only need to just think about this for a few moments. Knowing the German people as I do, they were a very thorough race of people. And that is, even if we assume for one moment, which I do not believe, not any, not under any circumstances will I believe that they embarked on a program of genocide against the Jews. But let's assume for one moment that they did have a program to do this. I couldn't imagine that a people with such thoroughness, such foresight, such ingenuity, would have to resort to taking Jews from various parts of the then German-occupied area, right inside Germany, to places where they'd have to keep them for a long time until they became emaciated on one thing or another, and then they would have to put them into ovens and gas them and do all this kind of nonsense, whereas anyone with a grain of intelligence knows very well that to transport people from France to Germany in the first place is ridiculous. Secondly, France is a very big country. It's not just a few hundred acres, it's many thousands of square miles, in which certain parts there is simply no people live whatever. The Germans could have, had they wished to, they could have established places there at very little expense where this could have been done. So is it not conceivable that this would have been their course rather than take these people by train or what have you, right across Germany and in some cases into Poland, in order to carry out this, what they're accused of doing? How can they account for the fact that in many of these prisoner of war camps were Jews who had been in there from before the war started? Jews which were taken prisoner because they were not, they were too dangerous from a political standpoint and propaganda standpoint and even from a physical standpoint to be allowed to have complete freedom. They were a danger to every German. And obviously the first thing that a country must do, and its political or military leaders, must safeguard its people. In order to do this, these people, many of whom, for instance, had been political agitators, for instance, when the war started and the Germans entered the Czechoslovakia, they were able to collect a large number of the people who had been in charge of the broadcasting paraphernalia in Czechoslovakia, who had been in Prague. They'd been pouring out invective against Germany for years and years, and the Germans knew who these people were. And when they did make their move into Czechoslovakia when the war started, these people were collected, and many of those who couldn't be trusted had to be put in camps out of the way. And strangely enough, many of these people were still in these camps when the war had ended. How can one explain this? Why keep these people all through the war had they have had a policy to exterminate them? I think the whole of Christian world has been led completely up the garden They wanted to believe this because it sounded feasible at the time. In order to justify the actions of Churchill and Eisenhower and all these other people who were associated with procuring the war in the first place and running it, they had to justify their actions. They had to justify the means they used. On this score, I have given much thought, and there is just no way that they can bring any logical, reasonable belief in the nonsense which they have tried to put over. Many people, as time goes on, many people will challenge the authenticity and accuracy of these statements. I think when one reads, for instance, the book which is now circulating, Did 6 Million Really Die? I think the answer that is to be found in that is, in my opinion, a very logical publication. How can they account for the fact that practically through the whole of the war, thousands upon thousands of Jews were working in factories, making clothing, making munitions, making aircraft parts, making radio parts and electronics, doing all exactly the same thing as what we were doing in Britain. In fact, they were an asset. It was only a minority of Jews who were put in concentration camps. Those who had shown by deed or action that at some time that they were not to be trusted. In consequence, they had to be put out of harm's way, where they couldn't get into any mischief. What would you think any other nation would have done with people who committed acts of sabotage as civilians? But, you see, all the things which the world has been told are all things which are very plausible to those whose ears have been attuned to this type of propaganda. It goes down very well indeed. It's just like the talk, for instance, of communism and the old rubbish that they trot out. Tell us, any people who have lived long enough among the dregs of humanity which have existed in any big cities to know, to be able to tell the difference between the type of propaganda which is fact and that which is fiction, will know very well that communism is nothing more or less than a window dressing to ensnare the feeble-minded idiots who believe in inequality. It tries to tell that there is an equality, some equality, which is absolute nonsense. There is no equality. There never has been an equality, and there never can be equality. The world in which we live has for a good many years given equality of opportunity from schooling. If a person, boy or girl, has had the ability genetically, they have been able to get to the top. And with all the promises that the left can give, particularly what is going on today with the shysters who have crept into the education business all over the world, particularly in America, who try to instill us, shall we say, with hopes and theories of equality until teaching the children all this nonsense about equality. There can never be any equality in the way that they try to put it over. If one wants to take this business of equality to its utmost extreme, we can even say there are no two of anything alike on the face of the earth. We cannot expect from one person to do exactly the same as another. Each person, each living creature, is an entity unto itself. But of course, to go back to my previous talk concerning Germany, the last time I was in Germany, I was very sad to see that a good many of these creatures had returned to Germany and had been successful in bringing about a guilt complex among the Germans. They had been, in truth, emasculated. Not only dispossessed, but they had been emasculated. They have created there many of the same type of subhuman creatures who can be found almost anywhere in the English-speaking world, particularly, of course, America, and now Great Britain, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, long hair, unmanly men, masculine females, so-called liberated. When I look at some of the German soldiers, wear a hairnet because their hair is so long, I say to myself, my God, whatever did all these men die for? What was it all about? The more one thinks of the world as it is today in comparison to what it was before the war, when I think back even to my childhood, when people, it was a different world altogether. Courtesy prevailed. The common everyday occurrence for a man to give his seat to a woman or an old person in a bus or a tram or a train. Common thing that on a Sunday he would put on a Sunday suit, change from what he wore during the week, and he would walk out, go into the parks, which were not all strewn with litter and rubbish, and there would be bands playing in the parks. People had the time to say good morning and good afternoon and raise their hat as a salutation of respect to each other and their neighbours. Today, we live, most of us, in a jungle by comparison. These days, I don't believe we'll ever come back within the foreseeable future. There is no doubt in my mind who the real enemy of man in general is it is comparatively a very small number of people. They control the banks and they control the media. The media in all its forms. Are the enemy because they are no longer to be relied upon, they are no longer to be trusted. It matters not what country one goes into today, in the English-speaking world, one can buy a newspaper, be it the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the Daily Telegraph from London, the Daily Express, the Mirror, the Sun, the Cape Argus, the Auckland Star, the New Zealand Herald. Makes no difference, any of these papers. The editorials are all as if they come out of the same sausage machine. They all say exactly the same. They do not give opinion of what the man in the street is saying. They create opinion by half-truths, by innuendo, by a lot of flapdoodle, by people who have no real knowledge of what is going on. People get quite a lot of relief, in a sense, by writing letters to the editor. Which, of course, is absolutely a waste of time. Because a situation which prevails all over exactly the same, no editor will guarantee to print a letter, any letter verbatim, for a start. The public have no idea how many letters an editor has received on any specific subject. They have no idea how many have been for or against any specific event. So therefore, the editor sits pretty, only the editor knows. The public do not know. They have no way of knowing. They are in a position to mould people's minds, and have been doing this for a number of years, to such an extent that people really believe most of the rubbish which is published. Like wealth, the public cannot discern what is wealth, what is real wealth. And just the same as they cannot discern sincerity when they read it in the paper. The only sincerity would be likely to come from small provincial papers. The big dailies are no longer to be trusted, whatever. The same as real wealth is not gold, silver and diamonds. These things are comparatively valueless. But they ought to change into gas and evaporate into the air and be lost forever, the truth of the matter is that the world would be no poorer. The only people that would be poor really would be those who have given money to purchase these things, or those who are sitting on mountains of it, and we all know who those are. I specifically intended that my main discussion or talk would be centred around Germany. Well, it still is, basically. However, It is necessary, perhaps, in order to illustrate or further amplify my views associated with Germany, that I shall have a quick cook's tour, as it were, around the world as we see it today, in the toward the latter part of 1975. The whole world, almost, is on fire. And the real enemy in the world today is only kept in position by the financiers. The whole structure of communism would never be where it is today had it not have been for the backing received by the American banks and the American internationalists and the comparative 1,000 corporations. There are approximately 1,000 huge international corporations which control the world. Now, the Reserve Bank, it is to be noted, in America, is not owned by the American government. And according to the American Constitution, none other than the government is permitted to produce currency, print currency, and yet we find that the American Reserve Bank is printing currency. Quite a shrewd guess, of course. Most of us know who the Reserve Bank is fed by. It's fed by, of course, the big banks, the Chase Manhattan Bank, the Rockefellers, and so on and so forth. But when a country loses control over its own economic values, then I'm afraid its number is up, unless it very smartly changes its ways. As far as Germany is concerned, although they have been dissipated to such a degree, debauched perhaps is a better word, I think there still remains, in odd pockets there, some glimmer of hope for these people. Or I am aware that the parents, when the parents of today's spoilt brats within Germany and in Britain and in other places, when they have gone, they will leave behind their progeny. I speak now of those who have not been tainted by racial admixture with Negro or other subspecies. I think myself that their genes, although they lie dormant, the deep-rooted genes of the Germanic will for survival will ultimately surface again. I have a great belief in this. Although the white man, I believe, is outnumbered some 6 or 7 to 1, I believe, through an awareness of this potential, not necessarily an agreement politically, one of the mistakes that white men have made is because they do not agree with each other politically, they think they have nothing in common. There are those among us, of course, as white men, who will never have any intelligence. It has been due to these idiots, of course, who have been responsible, wittingly or unwittingly, of selling us down the river, as it were, into the hands of the enemy. So it doesn't signify that purely because a man is white, he is necessarily going to do or even think of doing the right thing. But I think if we can stop or prevent a large enough number of people from destroying themselves racially, there is still hope. I'm a firm believer that things work in cycles. One is to wish one reads history, one sees that on so many occasions, history repeating itself. And I think it will repeat itself again. I think it is the people who are likely to survive in the generations to come will be those who have the highest standing in intellectual ability. And unless people are forced at gunpoint to destroy themselves by cohabiting with lesser species, they will make a comeback. So this is how I feel about Germany. I think that personally I fervently believe that people of German and Anglo-Saxon blood, if a sufficiency of them can come through the next two or three trying decades, and they will be trying, I think there is every chance in the world that they will once again attain the leadership in the world. I think this fervently, and I really believe it, just as I believe that the others, particularly now those on the African continent, are more likely to destroy themselves by the way that they are going. I think many people would probably agree with me on this point. However, I sincerely hope that you enjoyed and found my discussion of some interest and entertainment. I have noted, after replaying the earlier part of this tape, that once again I made a mistake. I referred to Cologne as 80,000 during the war. The figure, of course, is 800,000. The number killed in one raid was 80,000.